Actually, I did a trick the other second. I was breathing loud and it also quieted people. That wasn't intentional. Anyway, welcome to this presentation. This is called DDD is Back, the Backbone of Microservices. I'm Jimmy Nilsson and I have Martin Hellspång with me today.
Yeah, so Jimmy, he's the founder and CEO of Factor 10, speaker, visionary, all around good guy.
Well, looking for a raise.
It's been a while.
Yeah, and Martin is one of our consultants for a long time, been working on microservices projects lately, a lot, several of our projects. I was sitting in at the keynote this morning. It was very nice because he talked about microservices all the time. We just don't have that word ubiquity in the presentation, but just keep it in mind because it's quite similar, place and context and things like that. Okay, so we're going to start with a couple why, what, and how. First, a couple of whys. So the first question is, why are we really here today, all of us? I think there are several different answers to that, of course. You want to learn new stuff, what's new, what's coming, and so on. You want to hook up with old friends and learn to know a couple of new friends for the future. But if we look at the big picture, I think we and you and we are all here, actually, in order to develop the world.
Okay, well, develop the world, that sounds a little bit silly, Jimmy. But okay, I think I know what you mean. And it has something to do with what was said in the keynote, I think, because what is it that makes us developers here today different from the developers of the past? So if you could imagine what a developer conference would look like in the past, and we can go way past, imagine 500 years ago, imagine Rome, Italy, in the year 1516. They probably had a conference, the Rome Tech Days in 1516. And my guess is the one of the guys who were there, probably the keynote speaker, was Leonardo da Vinci. He was living in Rome at this time, 500 years ago. And actually, da Vinci, he was clearly a developer. He had the skills and the mindset of a great developer. And he did awesome hacks, and he was well ahead of his time. Someone should even write a book about his coding days. Could be called the Da Vinci Code, I guess. But anyway, even though he arguably, Da Vinci, was the most brilliant developer of his day, he could not actually change the world. But we, the group in this room, we actually can change the world because we work in software and software with the internet and the ubiquity of things and so on. Makes us, we have the actual power to change the world. So one small deploy for us developers could mean a giant leap for mankind. So Jimmy asked, why are we here? We're here to learn how to do development right. But we're really arguing that it's even more important to develop the right things, because if you just do the first thing, you develop stuff very with technical excellence, but it's not the right thing to do, then it's completely irrelevant what you do. It doesn't really matter if you have 5 gold stars and no users. So this is really, really important. And put it in a business context, it means that you must do the things that create business value instead of just doing technical exercises that has no business value.
So why do the right thing, as Martin said? We are trying to do the right thing because that is creating business value. It's not going to happen the first try, second, but sooner or later it's going to happen. So it's, yeah, we need to be sustainable. And that's the reason why we need to do the things right as well. Because the first try is not going to work out perfectly. So I have a little curve here. This is how software looks like to most people outside this room, I would say. So the cost of change increases dramatically over time, exponentially over time. So when you come up with a need for something, or the business people come up with a new idea that is probably going to make it, if the software is in bad shape, you can't make that change without it going to take a long time or being extremely expensive or being very risky. So we can't have this situation. We need to do the things right as well. Those two goes hand in hand. We need this curve instead. It's probably cheaper to do changes at the at the early days, but we will learn over time. Things change around us. We need to be able to make changes cheaply over time. So we definitely need this. So I think technology may never be a hinder to business development. It should be the opposite. It should enable business development. So we need to do the things right also for creating business value. So let's have a look at the dark ages. Let's take a step back 10, 15 years ago and see what it all looked like. We did a tremendously cool animation there for come out. Do you know what this is? 15 years ago it was the year 2001, exactly. This is the monolith of 2001. So that's one of the things we liked back then. So a couple of different things in the good old days, I always said. I meant when we had more problems than we have today. One of the things was that I really liked design, I thought, and I really liked databases. So layers was the coolest thing and my tool I used for everything. So it could look like this. I spent loads and loads of time on the database design because that was key for achieving something good, I knew. I also spent quite a lot of time on the data access, and I wrote lots of sprocs and views and things like that. And at that point in time, I had used most of the time of the project, actually, so I had to speed up a little bit now for the not-so-important stuff like the kind of describing the business and the user interaction and how the experience should be for the user. I spent quite a little time on that. So, but I had lots of layers, many more than is shown here, because each layer was protecting what was underneath it. So a layer was good, I thought. On the other hand, although I had all that protection, I also sent around data structures globally everywhere without any protection at all. So the protection was like actually not working at all. That was one thing. I used that over and over again. I thought that was key to success. Something else we did a lot was not understanding Conway's law. We had organizations looking like this. One little department for the DBAs, one for the user interface team, one for the business logic team. And what happens when you organize like this is that your application will look like that as well. That is what Conway is saying. So we came up with something looking like this with very, very tough borders between the user interface and the core and the core and the database. So when there was a new problem coming up, each of those groups tried to solve it within their own group, of course. It's just painful going to the next group. But a function has a tendency of spanning all those. So this is very ironic. We do our best not to communicate. It's the opposite to what is a good idea, I think. And again, if you have an architecture like this now, that will actually embrace or make that organization even stronger. So they are both feeding each other. Another thing that happened over and over again was that we were considered to have too low productivity in our projects. And when you have too low productivity, what should you do? Any proposal? You're not program managers? Exactly, add people. I wasn't just saying consultants, but yeah. Throw people on the problem. That's a good way of solving it. It's hilarious, I think. Even worse, and I did this over and over again myself, I was allergic to adding people for solving a productivity problem, but it still happened. And then I said, okay, let's do this then. But the new people, they have to become like the rest little group here. They have to use TDD, they have to do that and do it. That's not going to happen either. That's not the way it works. You can't just tell people, be like Zlatan. It doesn't work like that. Of course not. So actually, this is the reason microservices started for me. I felt frustrated over and over again that some wanted to work in a certain way and be productive that way, and they tried to force others who didn't like that style to do the same. And it just ended up with miserable people everywhere, very, very low productivity. And over the years, we have been forced to kind of to create larger and larger systems. And this is a monolith sketch I have here of one system, a dependency graph. This is not a dependency graph between classes, it's between assemblies, actually. So this is creating quite a heavy cognitive load, I would say. When you need to do something, it's everything hooks together. That said, several of the friends I consider the smartest I've ever met, they are still saying that they would start every new project with a monolith. Don't start with complex stuff first. Go there when you need it. But there is always a risk that the complexity comes and bites you before you are ready to deal with it. Yet another problem we had over and over again was that we kind of forgot about friction. We thought about, let's just do everything perfect this time and adhere to the rules and no bad decisions. And this is not how it works. We have friction, and that's actually a good thing because we would fall off the planet, I guess, without it. So we can't... I have never seen it work to get rid of friction for more than a minute or something like that. And then friction comes back and bites us. So this is killing us if we pretend it's not there. So a couple of different things that we had over and over again. And the result, I think, was, yeah, we created graphs looking like this over and over again. So the question then is, how can we get out of this situation? I think microservices is at least one of the tools for solving or dealing with a couple of those problems. So let's have a look at what that is. As a matter of fact, back then, we already had the answer in front of us. You know the answer to all that misery? You can almost always say it because it's this. Have you read it? Domain-driven design, Eric Evans. If you haven't read it, that's good news, because then you have the best time of your life in front of you. This is going to change your life. You will become happier after you read it a couple of times. So, the presentation was called DDD is back. Actually, Microsoft asked me to use that title. To me, it has never left, so it's a little bit strange title. What happened? DDD is about thinking. That never goes out of fashion. So, anyway, it comes back with a tool for us that definitely helps us deal with all those problems I just talked about. And that's the reason why it's back. We have one more very strong reason for knowing about it. That, together with what I call web philosophy, is kind of the path out from the misery. What I mean with web philosophy was that back at this time, over and over again, big enterprises had this notion that let's try to create the perfect world where everything is in order. And again, friction is a problem in that case. The web is totally different. The web is basically chaos. Everybody's doing everything differently, except they are adhering to a tiny, 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 tiny protocol. We have dumb pipes and smart endpoints. And actually, that works. That is dealing with that chaos in a way that is definitely transferable to the companies, to the enterprise as well. We can use the same stuff. The enterprise isn't that different from the internet. few years after domain-driven design was written, there is a book published by Jim Weber that is called REST in Practice that I think captures a lot of the web philosophy. Also written in 2010, another book was written that I only read recently, The Art of Action, that is also very much about the philosophy behind microservices, I think. It's maybe not the inspiration for microservices, but it describes it. But that book describes actually military philosophy, saying that, as a matter of fact, when you send out a group of people to a place that they should do some mission there, you have no idea how that place looks like when they go there. Everything is probably changing before they hit the place, maybe even the goal for the mission, and so on. So, Art of Action, the US Marines, for example, live after this. They are creating tiny groups of four people, and they are supposed to live in chaos, not in without friction. Everything is friction. Microservices is built for this chaos of reality, I think.
So we're now going to talk a little bit about the two major parts in the domain-driven design book called the strategic design chapters, where bounded context is probably the most important one. So it's a modularization concept, and as with all modularizations, you want high cohesion within and low coupling between. That's just very standard modularization. But why are we even talking about this? It's because if you have the big monolith, if you have an enterprise model to try to capture your big enterprise entire set of domains into one huge model to rule them all, that's actually an anti-pattern. And we'll get to why in a minute. Because what we actually want to do is break it down, the model, into micro models, if you will, smaller models, one per bounded context. But is that really a good idea? I mean, what if there's shared concepts? You have a web shop with a sales order, and you have a warehouse where you want to pick that sales order. Isn't that the same concept? Well, sure, the concept is shared, but you don't actually need to share the model. The big shared model is still an anti-pattern, so because sharing stuff means you're not independent from your peers in the which you share stuff. So what we're really saying also is that it's okay to trade some duplication. You have perhaps the sales order class in both the web shop and the warehouse bounded context, and you shouldn't be afraid of having the same class in two places because it's models two different things or two different aspects of the same same concept. So you get a simple razor sharp model because you can apply the you ain't gonna need it principle. So in this bounded context, you ain't gonna need stuff. That you, for example, in the web shop, you might need to have the sales order remember currencies, rate of exchange, have currency conversion functions. People want to pay in euros and so on. But in the warehouse context, perhaps that's irrelevant. You just need to know the item number and the shelf location and the quantity, perhaps. So it's not you're not polluting that model with more detail than you actually need. And then, obviously, if you have a lot of models and you have microservices coupled to this, then you will need communication. And this is in the domain-driven design book described in something called a context map. And there are a lot of integration strategies described in the book. We won't have time to just run through them all. So I'm just going to mention one of the most important ones, the anti-corruption layer, which basically is meant to translate between an external model and an internal model and keep bad data out. That's the name of it. Null values, zero quantity items, stuff that you not really care about in your domain.
Okay, I actually learned about something that I was praising this book being amazingly good. It's like poesy and poetry is the English word. But actually I found out something is wrong in it. I learned it in the keynote today because Eric is talking about a ubiquitous language, such as a language that is everywhere. That's actually wrong because he's not talking about a language that is one and the same everywhere. He's talking about a language for a certain place. And according to the, that place is a bounded context. So according to the keynote, it should not be ubiquitous language, it should be ubiquity language. And yeah, anyway, let's continue. So having this tool called domain-driven design connected to web philosophy, to me this is at least one of the microservices styles. This is the one I'm looking for over and over again, and to me this makes a lot of sense. And trying to just summarize it quickly, finding those microservices, to me those the first level of microservices is the bounded context. We are going to talk more about how to find them in a minute. The second thing is that we have learned that organization and architecture has a tendency of, well, going together somehow. Why not use that instead of trying to fight it? Let's just make them aligned and benefit from it, benefit from the communication going on within that place. Also, something in the past that was very common was that it was more important to use the same technology stack everywhere than to use the right technology for each problem. I totally disagree on that. We should, of course, go for the right solution to each problem instead. It's more important to have the right solution than to use the same solution everywhere. Isn't it obvious? Totally obvious, I think. Another thing I said before, that I think it's troublesome adding people to a late project. As a matter of fact, this situation of using microservices, it might work at least better than ever before. Let's get back to that in a minute also. And finally, it's all very much about autonomy and having isolated parts. Each of them should be able to take care of themselves, whatever happens around them. So they are ready for the chaos.
So here we have our monolith again. And on the outside it looks black and shiny, but on the inside it's actually warm and fuzzy and in multicolor. And what we're trying to show here is that while you want to have clear boundaries in your monolith, you want to have isolation and so on, it's not that your programming language, or most of them at least, don't. There are some modularization concepts, but it's easy to, or at least too easy, to go and poke around in internals of other things, making the boundaries less clear-cut than you would want. So as if you oppose this style to the microservices style of architecture, you have much clearer boundaries. So Eric Evans said in a presentation about microservices, he said that, okay, finally, bounded context get a actual boundary. So this is tremendously important for the isolation and the independence of these services that you have. But as we already mentioned, there's an important lesson here, and I think it's, do you know what monolith means, by the way? It's actually the word one stone. And so it's obviously smart to use a monolith, okay? We shouldn't, the best microservices are the ones you don't have to write because you have a simple enough problem to do a monolith instead. It's just much simpler to put things together if they're in the same process. You don't have a lot of problems communicating across processes. And so you shouldn't underestimate this. Only when your monolith becomes big enough to justify breaking it apart, making it into microservices, this is going to be a win for you. So this is also very much into the to the introduction, where we said that it's important to do the right thing and the thing right. Perhaps you think the thing right is doing microservices, but it could be costly for your business just because you thought it was fun.
Okay. Next section then, the how. Maybe I got, I was creating the impression that someone else was making all those mistakes I talked about in the dark ages. That was not the case. I did them all, over and over and over again. So, I'm often saying that I have probably the world record in mistakes, and that's sometimes sad, but if you are able to learn some from it, that's good. So here are a couple of stories, what we have learned over the years. A couple of good things and a couple of troublesome things. First thing, though, is this little sketch here, which is trying to model business-aligned microservices. The bad news about microservices is that it's quite hard to find those boundary contexts, or not finding them, but deciding on how they should look like. I'm doing it wrong over and over and over again. But it's like always, you can't stop with the first try. You have to iterate it, and over time it will show itself. The good news is that the people that know a lot about what those microservices should be are your colleagues, your business colleagues. They have so much input here for you. So we should definitely communicate a lot with them, collaborate with them. And they are great developers, actually. So not create that gap between business and development. That's counterproductive. You should instead go together, of course. We're saying that all the time. But this is a good situation where I think that has been proven. The sketch you are seeing here is actually taken from a real project. I just changed the names of the microservices to not reveal secrets. And this sketch, we are starting each and every discussion with the business people. Let's think about this. Okay, let's go to the map, they say. And we start here. This is the big picture of all they are doing, and the system and the architecture and everything. It all goes together and sits together. We are talking the same language at the first minute in that discussion, because we are starting here. I also think actually that this picture helps them to think about their business too. It's not just about for helping us. It goes in both directions over and over again. Common saying is that when we have problems with productivity, it doesn't help to add people because 9 women can't create 1 child in 1 month. We've heard that over and over again. But as a matter of fact, 9 women can create 9 children in 9 months. That's a little bit different, but still very interesting. And I think that comes back to microservices, because we are finding good borders where we don't have to communicate a lot over or between the different microservices. We are running at full speed within our own microservice and only communicating every now and then, if we find the right borders, that is. If we have that situation, we will be able to run at full speed in each of those and actually create 9 microservices at the same time, in parallel. It's not solving all problems out there, of course not. But to me, at least, this is a step in the right direction of being able to do more development with more people at the same time. As always, of course, again, you can't find the Zlatans for each and every of those, or they are different in... there are different problems for making some of those microservices become a little bit less perfect for what you needed. That's not so troublesome either in this situation, because a problem with one of those services is not affecting the others. They are isolated from each other. So you just have to deal with that troublesome microservice and recreate it and try another thing. But the rest are just fine. They are coping with that problem outside there. It's not affecting them internally. And that's a very important reason for microservices, I think, making them possible to live with over time, to make them sustainable. Okay, a common trap. I think this is something from the developer reality. We hear this new cool thing, we have to try it out, and we always have a tendency of taking it to the extreme. And we go to the business people and tell them why they should go for microservices, and they don't understand a word we are saying, but they, leave them alone, they say, I guess, something like that. So we try it out, and here I have, this is trying to show a whole bunch of tiny, tiny microservices. This is like when SOA became fashionable a couple of years ago. Then the best service you could come up with in SOA had one lines of code, because they were sprinkling down, and all of a sudden that was the best service, that one-liner. It had only one problem. It totally lacked cohesion. None of those are doing anything interesting at all on their own. So think about those tiny pieces here. They can't do anything interesting. Of course, they are not at all aligning with the business, but let's forget about that for now. Just talking about the technical problems here. So they are not doing anything interesting, but they need to be able to cope with all problems around them. So instead of doing stuff, they are actually just compensating for problems around them. To me, this is a common trap. We shouldn't do this. Micro doesn't mean one-liners, in my opinion. Definitely not at the first level, at least. We should start from doing interesting stuff, smart endpoints. So let's do it like this instead. Now it's not microservices inside, it's perhaps classes or something like that. And now not everything is connected any longer between the borders. Within the borders, I don't actually care too much of if it's a bit messy, because it's not affecting the outside. I'm not affected by that mess over there because I have a border around it. So to me, this is a much nicer picture. Now we are doing interesting stuff within each of those larger circles, and we don't have to compensate that much. Only a couple of things at the border is we need to take care of if our friend is having problems or doing wrong stuff with us, so to say. So we should go for high cohesion. Low coupling and high cohesion, they come together. We need to find a balance there, not just going for one of them. It's obvious, of course, but still very common. I see it over and over again that people are trying to create thousands of microservices and thinking that's a good thing. I'm not so sure. So start with why. Why do you really need to go with microservices? That's an important question, I think. Not because it's hip. Of course not. You should do it for some other reason.
Speaking of hip things, something that often is mentioned together with microservices is Docker. So how many of you show hands have tried out, just played around with Docker?
I actually hate it.
You hate it, yeah?
So much friction. Sorry.
Now you're shipwrecking me, you know. Anyway. So what you can read on the docker.com website is this quote, which to me, when I started looking at Docker, this was the promise that was really interesting. It packages an application in a container, guarantees it will work the same anywhere, in production, locally, anywhere. And it's just, we all have been in the situation where stuff works on my machine, not on the other ones, not in production, and so on. And this sounded like the perfect solution to that. But in reality, what happens is that you have, for example, these four just random microservices, you have a couple of nice looking small microservices. They are really easy to get running on your laptop. And then maybe you need a proxy to load balance or just simplify access from a browser to these microservices. And then maybe you need storage, and you might need search and indexing, and you probably one idea could be to have one storage and indexing and search per microservices, because they could use a different solution. And then maybe you need to have an event bus to communicate between the services, and perhaps you have a legacy system that you integrate with, and you now need logging because you have 10 containers spewing out different things. In you have to know where to look for them, and it's, I mean, 10 different log commands to get to your logs, and the logging needs storage and a dashboard, and you have metrics perhaps in your production environment, and you want to see them, and that also needs storage and a dashboard. Alerting. And perhaps for performance reasons, you actually need some kind of cache for static files, and then you need to consider that you wanted actually to deploy to the cloud. So now you need probably an orchestration framework, or you're completely blind to what happens in the cloud. And it needs storage and dashboard. And you need to consider yourself which services are going to go together on which virtual machine. Is this kind of partitioning? And once you get to this level of, you had four nice looking microservices. This is not something that you're realistically going to be able to run the same way on your laptop as in the real deployment. So the Docker promise, we need to keep in mind that the Docker promise is for one single container. This will work the same. You deploy it here, there, everywhere. But a group of containers, a group of microservices, you're not going to be able to replicate the production environment locally. And it's just way too complex. It would take minutes to get this up and running. You want to test a little thing and minutes to wait. Just bring up the four ones and communicate with those, and leave the others out if possible. So what we're saying is also that you can have a tech stack per microservices, and this is because this separation of concerns and separation and isolation means that each team can use the optimal programming language, architecture, persistence solution. It's really doesn't matter to the other services as long as you play along nicely with them. Somehow, what's at the boundaries, that matters. And as Jimmy was saying before, there is, of course, a trade-off here. Do you want the monoculture? Everything must be C#. We always use SQL Server. We have this kind of architecture. All microservices should be stamped from that. That's good for some organizations, perhaps. It's good for you don't have to retrain people. But on the other hand, perhaps SQL Server and C# wasn't the optimal solution for this problem. You could have a graph database and Prolog for this particular problem. I'm not sure, but it shouldn't affect the other microservices. So you could obviously go too far in either direction here.
Okay, a couple of examples for using that possibility we have from microservices. In this case, I'm choosing technique regarding storage in a couple of unorthodox ways. This is taken from different projects over a couple of years. Some of them are maybe not so weird today, but back then it was really weird. For example, the first one was just breaking all rules in a very large company. We were having a situation of storing graphs with hundreds of thousands of nodes each, and that was taking minutes of storing and minutes of reading, and they were doing that quite a lot. So the solution we came up with was that those graphs, why not just serialize them and store them as blobs instead? And that turned out very well in that project, at least. All of a sudden, the storing and the reading was 100 times faster not a couple of percents, but totally different situation. It changed the application totally. Also, lots of the code that was mapping between those very different models were gone, because we only had one model that was in memory and it was at disk. Quite nice. Again, this didn't affect everything, because it was in one microservice. It was within the borders of that one. If it turned out to be a total failure, we could change it. Nothing outside was affected of it. So this makes it much more easy for us to do experiments and try out new ideas we have. The second example was that we started out with a new application in a situation where the culture was very much relational database design focused, so to say. So lots of the problems were solved with creating very cool SQL statements instead of making decisions in the design, so to say. So we actually said, maybe we should really force people to do the design, and what's the easiest that could possibly work? Maybe using files for persistence. And that's extremely low-tech, of course. We only had a couple of thousand documents or resources to store, so this seemed like working out for at least some of the services. At least when we put all that data in memory, and that sounds maybe obvious today that we have so much memory. A couple of years ago, it felt like data should be on disk all the time. Well, why? Why keep reading and writing if we know we can have it in memory all the time? That's actually changing the situation quite a lot. And again, it's not affecting everything. It's within one service. A couple of years later, it was planned from the beginning. Let's swap this out when it's not good enough any longer. But it's still being used. And I don't think it's in plans right now, at least, for swapping it. It's fine. It's all doing what it should. And the third example, again, we had problems with I/O, very large stuff. Very large calculations were stored and read back. I/O was a bottleneck. So we tried out to not store it at all, just store the input and do the simulation once again when we need it. The CPU was much faster than the I/O in that situation, at least. So that has the nice effect of nothing is shared. Just add machines with more CPUs, not having the I/O become a bottleneck worse and worse over time. Okay, Martin is having a great demo. I'd like him to spend some time on that. So just one more thing before we move to the demo, I think. A common trap when breaking down a monolith. I think microservices is a great tool for taking on a situation when we have come to a situation that is just too complex. We are kind of getting to the end of the road here. We need to do something. Microservices might be the tool for you. I think that's a good idea. But what I see over and over again is that companies are running very large projects, and after that project, the monolith is now looking like this. Quite nice. They found the boundaries, and everything is working for them. But as you see on those services, I'm not having very, very thick boundaries. And the reason for that is that they didn't have the power or the money for also dealing with the database. So they end up in this situation. The problem now is that the benefits of the microservices is not actually there, because every change they need to do, they have to communicate with all the rest of the services and to sync with them. Can I make that change? Because they are sharing the database. So I'm not sure this is the right way. I would propose going in this direction instead. Maybe not such a huge project, but a smaller project, and do it all the way down. Take care of the database as well, so that service is isolated and autonomous. And this is a good first step. If you run out of money now, at least you have achieved something. In the first picture, I'm not sure that actually was a better situation, to be honest. I think this is a better situation. If you have more money, move on from here.
Yeah, so this is the same slide again. So another common trap. and another big project, and another split into a couple of microservices, or and then you have the monolithic user interface on top of that. And we try to have had a couple of tries at breaking that apart, and I'm going to do a small demo about that. And what we try to do is have the microservices. They each define their own user interface. And one way to get that work is if you have, this is a cheesy browser image. But one way to get that to work is the first try we had was using iframes. So the website, the main site opened up dialogues from one of the other sites. I mean, these are the three microservices are three. They are web servers, right? So you you call into those, but so you then you get the UI combined somehow. But this is a model as a kind of a cleanup of that, where we put a proxy between the browser and the services. And what the proxy does here is simply have one single point where the browser is communicating, so it doesn't have to do the cross-site fetching of data, because that is a security problem according to the browser. So we then you need to have all the services allow cross-origin requests, which sometimes you get into browser compatibility problems as well. So I have a small demo about this, and let's hope the demo gods are going to play ball.
And while Mattis thought that, I think going with storage per microservice, that is quite common nowadays. UI per microservice, that's still, I'm not sure that's common. I think that's, is that a good idea? I'm not sure either. I think it is. So we are trying it out over and over again. It works gracefully, I think, to us. But that is not so common and de facto.
Okay, so what I'm going to show you is a small sample which has a warehouse, a shipping service, shop service, and a portal app that ties all these things together. They're built and containerized in Docker. And just as an example, you can go to the shop service and say .net run, because this is a ASP.NET Core app running on the Mac. So it's available at the local host. And this hasn't gotten a you can't browse to this. Well, you can, I guess. But I'm going to use curl to see if I can talk to this service and ask it for some information about the host. And you see above, then it starts getting requests, and it says, okay, this is running on the Apple OS X Darwin kernel on my MacBook. But if we instead we kill that one, and we don't do the run the demo instead, this is just starting up four different Docker containers. Now they got random IPs and random ports, because all of them are using port 5000, but they're actually, as you can see, so they're using port 5000 there, and the other one is also, the shop service is also using port 5000, but they have different IPs.
Do you notice the low friction here with Docker and stuff?
Yeah. So, then I have the site, which is just a very small Angular JS example. And what this is going to do then is web shop, warehouse, and shipping are going to call into the other microservices and fetch the UI and controller from them. So they're really defined by the microservices themselves. And a trigger warning for people who don't like bad UIs, this is going to be horrendous, because I just, for, this is supposed to, the yellow things is coming from the web shop, the blue things is coming from the warehouse, and the green things are coming from the shipping. So, and you, you are on the logs output here, you see that, okay, it got, someone asked for the shipping HTML view. And the proxy said, the app is hosted in the proxy, which is an Nginx, an Nginx web server and reverse proxy. And you basically tell it, if you scroll up a little bit, this is the configuration of the Nginx proxy. So it says something that shipping is on this IP, warehouse is on this IP, and the web shop is on that IP. And if you scroll down a little bit, there's a lot of magic. And then here it says, okay, location slash everything there, fetch that from this folder where I put the Angular app, the portal app, and then whenever someone asks for slash shipping, pass that on to wherever the server's doing a shipping service, because that's a different web sub. So what I've also done is just adding a small info button, so you can go to the web shop, and it asked the service, where are you running? And this is running now on .NET Core. This is the host name, but in Docker, the host name is usually a container ID. And it's running on Linux, because that's how you run Docker on a Mac for now. You have a Linux VM. And if you look at the warehouse, the blue one, this is going to say that it's actually built in Python instead. But this isn't not something we notice from here. Obviously, I did it. But this is not obviously not something we are going to expose to users. So it doesn't really matter. We have to have a common interface where it's fetching data and so on. And I think we should, I could do more of this demo afterwards, but let's go back to the presentation or we will run out of time. So what you must understand, we have said it twice, I think, you can't just build a microservices solution and think this is going to be easier than doing a monolith. Because you're now starting to build a distributed system. You have, instead of one monolith, you have many moving parts. You have a lot of things starting up, going down. So what's going to happen inevitably is that your system is going to be partially available. It's not the case that often for a monolith. Of course, your app could be up and running, but the database could be down. But then it doesn't really matter often. But in a multi-service scenario, you're going to have the shipping service down. You're going to have the event bus down. You're going to have the database down. You need to take care of that. And that's not you don't often have to do anything about that in a monolith. It either is fully up or it's not working at all. As I showed on the Docker slide, which the multitude of containers, you probably need some kind of discovery, maybe orchestration tools to help them find each other if they're going to communicate cross-service. Because especially in the Docker world, they just get allocated a new IP when they start. It could even be on a random port.
And just a tiny comment, if that's okay. Partially available. Just because we are able to have it running like that, a couple of things running, some are not, I think, in my opinion, it's very much of a business decision if that's a good idea or not. It depends on the situation very much. It can be very scary for the business to know that some will work and some will not, and they think it will end up in a bad situation. Or it might be a very good idea. So yes, it's not a technical decision, that was just my message.
And also, if you do messaging between services, you want the exactly once messages, but those aren't actually available. That's just a wishful thinking. On the other hand, in a monolith, if you do a method call, that's pretty much guaranteed to be exactly once. That's just way simpler to get the same result. And if you're not doing your microservices stateless, you're not going to be able to scale out horizontally by adding more shipping services, for example, or more web shops. Or if you have any kind of cache, or even if you have an event counter, or any kind of state in your service, if you're replicating that, then you also need to handle some kind of distributed cache, which is a complex problem. So that's also a complication of the distributed system that you're taking on while selecting a microservices architecture. So, in closing, domain-driven design is a tool to help you both do the thing right, technologically, boundaries, and it meshes very well with microservices, with bounded context, and microservices are really, really good together. And it also helps you do the right thing by helping you talk to the business, having shared language with the business people. You talk about the same things. And so it's really both of the do the right thing and do the thing right. It's always the case that the business is the most important thing. If you have to do a hack, but it creates a great value for the business, then it's the right thing to do instead of doing excellent things that isn't really solving any business problem. So domain-driven design is the message from us. That's a good tool for this. And the question from us also is, when will you come aboard this? We're going to stay here a little bit for questions afterwards, but feel free to stop us and have a chat.